This is The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry. Late Tuesday afternoon, the Centers for Disease Control announced an eviction moratorium targeted to areas of the country where there are substantial numbers of new COVID-19 transmissions. In practice, the new moratorium extends protections to about 90% of the nation's renters. Renters who spent several days facing the insecurity of potential eviction because the CDC's original national eviction moratorium expired on Saturday without congressional or White House action to extend it. The official position of the Biden administration is that they were double and triple checking their authority to extend the moratorium in light of the Supreme Court's decision in June that seemed to require congressional action for further eviction protections. Fastidious legal effort is undoubtedly part of the story, but millions of American families have someone else to thank for their temporary reprieve from fear of homelessness.
Cori Bush, Congresswoman, Missouri's 1st District.
Congresswoman Cori Bush is a registered nurse, community activist, organizer, single mother, and first-term representative of Missouri's 1st Congressional District. She's the first Black woman to represent Missouri and the first activist from the Movement for Black Lives elected to the United States Congress. I spoke with Congresswoman Bush before news of the new CDC moratorium became public. Representative Bush, you slept on the Capitol steps on Friday night. Why?
Yes, I've actually been here. Today is day five. I'm out here on the steps. And I'm out here because we cannot, as a country, allow 7 to 11 million people to end up sleeping on the street, to end up looking for shelter, looking for a home, because of a policy decision, because of inaction, because of what work did not happen coming out of U.S. Congress or the White House or the CDC, especially during this global pandemic. It's the same either way. Even if there was not a global pandemic, I would feel the same way. But that on top of the issues that we already have, there's no way that I could not do something.
Who has joined you out there on the steps, except, of course, for the very friendly dog that we hear barking?
yes, exactly. We have our policy advisors out here with us. But yes, so we have had the very first night we were out here, Congresswomen Ayanna Pressley and Ilhan Omar were out here. We have had Congressman Jamal Bowman and Mondaire Jones, Jimmy Gomez, Chairman of the Rules Committee, Jim McGovern. We have also had, of course, Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who's been out here with us quite a bit. Also, yesterday we had Representatives Mark Takano, and we had and on the Senate side. I'd be remiss if I didn't say Sarah Jacobs, Representative Sarah Jacobs from California. But then on the Senate side, we had Senator Elizabeth Warren. We've had Ed Markey, Bernie Sanders. We had Majority Leader Schumer actually out here with us yesterday. So it has. Oh, and we also Representative Adam Schiff.
So with all of these folks, I'm wondering if, so it's my understanding that part of what Democratic leadership was saying is that there simply wasn't time, capacity to build consensus, to move forward on legislative action. But sounds like you almost have a quorum on the front steps.
I know. And I also forgot the chairwoman of the Congressional Black Caucus, Joyce Beatty, was out here along with Sheila Jackson Lee. The fact that we've been asking for members to show up, we know that there are a lot of members, more members than not, that support this, that support the moratorium. But if we don't have the numbers, we just don't have the numbers, even if it's down to one or two. So the fact that members have been coming out to voice their support for the moratorium has made such a huge difference in the visibility. And also to pull on the heartstrings of those that are in our communities that can help apply pressure as well, because people that live in the districts of those that aren't supportive of this moratorium, you know, they want their members to stand up, and so that's what this has been helpful with.
Undoubtedly, the Biden White House could clearly hear the clarion calls issued by Democratic members of Congress and Senate from the steps of the Capitol. Representative Bush's protest was a classic organizer strategy. Her presence drew other members, and those members came with cameras, microphones, and media attention, which offered the opportunity for many to make direct appeals to the president, to party leaders, and to the people.
Eviction is a policy choice. And the fact that we failed to act, not out of an inability to do something to stave off this crisis, a national tent city, an eviction tsunami, it was an unwillingness. I agree with Chairwoman Waters, the author of the emergency bill. I serve on the Financial Services Committee. We should have fought harder. So again, families are running out of options, but we still have many available on the table, and we need to exhaust every single one of them.
It's now starting. The money is starting to move. But right now, we still have tens of billions of dollars that is unspent. I don't want to spend that money after people have been moved out of their homes. I want to use that money to keep people from being moved out of their homes.
We value real estate developers. We value big landlords. We value big banks. We value big money. And we don't value those who are working class, who are grassroots, who are struggling.
You heard there from Representative Ayanna Pressley, Senator Elizabeth Warren, and Representative Jamal Bowman. All were important to securing the CDC's new moratorium, but none matched the fervor and urgency of Congresswoman Bush, for whom commitment to the moratorium extension was not only political, it was personal.
For me, being someone who has lived unhoused, who did sleep in a car, was living out of a car with my two children and my partner, I know what it's like. And so it's not good enough for me to not do everything that I can, as well as work with my colleagues to get this done.
Now, you have, from the time that you announced that you were running for office, you have led with this belief that representing the people in part means leading from your own lived experience. You just told us a bit, but can you say a bit more about your experiences of eviction and what that teaches you in this moment?
Yeah, eviction looks so many different ways. Sometimes people think that eviction just means like, oh, somebody just did not pay their rent. Somebody just was being not responsible with their finances. That is most of the time not the case. For me, personally, being someone who was low wage and just had so many other issues. I had credit issues that were just so many credit issues from being low wage without health insurance, working for the same company for 10 years, going to the hospital for a sinus infection, instead of being able to go to a clinic, those type of things. It just adds to the poverty. Poverty is very expensive. And for me, for the eviction situations I've had, one of them, for example, was I was in an abusive relationship and my partner choked me and left me for dead, thought that I was dead. But because of the noise that violence caused, the landlord evicted me. And then I incurred all of these fees through eviction I could not afford to pay. Because for those that don't know, when you are evicted, once that information goes to the lawyer, it adds all of these fees. So even if you could come up with the money to pay the rent, now you have all of these fees. And so you are oftentimes aren't able to come up with that extra portion. So you are evicted. And so that's just one example of what happened.
Poverty is very expensive. Indeed, it is. Data from researchers at the Eviction Lab show that, quote, eviction is not just a condition of poverty. It is a cause of it. Unquote. In 2019, researchers from Columbia University and Boston University found that poor health often contributes to eviction because families cannot afford medical bills and housing costs. These researchers showed that one way to reduce evictions was to expand Medicaid. And domestic violence is, as it was for Representative Bush, a leading cause of homelessness among women. For more than a decade, domestic violence advocates have been battling with state legislatures to pass laws shielding survivors from eviction. But there are still states where a victim can be evicted simply for calling the police to protect her from her attacker. And the expense of eviction is not just financial. Children are forced to change schools. Families lose all their possessions. And evictions can keep families from finding new housing because landlords check for recent evictions. And of course, we are still living in a pandemic. Daily COVID infections are rising as the result of the highly contagious Delta variant. Now, Representative Bush is a nurse, and I asked her how the pandemic complicates the already challenging experience of eviction.
Thank you for asking that question. So, Melissa, when just as working as a nurse, so something that I've done for years I've been working with the unhoused community. Before Michael Brown was murdered and I took to the streets to be a part of the Ferguson and ended up a part of the Ferguson uprising. Before that, working as a pastor and out of a love for humanity, we were working the streets, helping our unhoused community members, getting them access to resources. And then on the nursing side, I would get off work and then go to the streets and be up all night helping people get to shelters, helping find blankets, going to get briefs for our elder. You know, I remember I had some veterans, our elder veterans, who needed help physically. So we would go to the store and get briefs and help them put on briefs and change their pants and, you know, like things, small things like that, that are huge for people that that people don't even realize is an issue. But we would be out on the street for hours every night trying to find shelter for people, trying to make sure they could get into their homes, making sure our trans community members had a place to go because sometimes they couldn't get in, making sure that our people who had issues, who were suffering from issues with cancer and some of these other issues, they could not get into shelters because if they had cancer and they had all these medications, they couldn't get in. And so trying to find places for them. And that was without a pandemic. And now we're talking about adding millions of people during a global pandemic. This is so unsafe. It's inhumane. It's cruel. It's unconscionable that this is happening in this country. And it was going to be allowed. It was. But no, we had to step. No. There's no way I could just sit back and allow it.
Now, I asked Representative Bush to situate this effort to extend the eviction moratorium within her longer work as an organizer in Ferguson, Missouri.
We know that the Black community will be most directly affected, the Black community. And so when we say Black Lives Matter, we don't say it because it sounds good or we want to announce to the world that we're better than everybody else. Like, you got to make us matter. No, we're saying it because we have been, it's proven, it is shown, there is research, there are numbers to support that Black lives don't matter in this country, in as evidenced by, at least don't matter enough in this country, as evidenced by the fact that we will be the number one group disproportionately affected by this crisis, along with our brown community, along with our LGBT community, our communities that are living, our people that are living with disabilities in this country. We all just disproportionately affected. In order to show that Black lives matter, to look at this and say, you know what, Black people are going to be most directly affected by this. We need to do something because we, our Black community, when we talk about so many different disparities, whether health disparities because of COVID-19, it has ravaged Black communities. It has taken out Black community members. The numbers have hit Black women the hardest, but Black men are oftentimes the ones that have died the most. When we look at that, And compound that with putting people out on the street, and we understand that there's a wage inequality, but there's also racial wage gap. When we add all of those things together, how can we not speak up and say that we will not allow these inequities to continue? Because, and as they also harm our Black community members so deeply and so intently, and that's why we have to say, look. Right in everybody's faces. Yes, Black Lives Matter. And I'm going to keep saying it. I'm going to keep putting that out on the forefront because until it shows in the actions and in the numbers, we got to keep putting it out there.
Data support the Congresswoman's insight about race and vulnerability to eviction. Research from the Eviction Lab shows that filing and eviction rates are significantly higher for Black renters than for white renters. For example, nearly a third of all eviction filings were filed against Black people, even though they made up just about 20% of renters. Most vulnerable to eviction? Black women and their children. What do you want to see from the White House?
I want to see from the White House a moratorium on evictions today. I want to see it today. I want to see the White House say, because we understand that the White House is saying, look, we want to get this done. Like, we agree. We want this. But they're also saying, talking about a possible court challenge, not having the legal standing to be able to do so. I'm asking the White House to let's just do this thing. Let's just get it done. Let's get the moratorium done. If there's going to be a legal challenge, let us work on the legal challenge, you know, but the possibility of a legal challenge cannot be greater than the devastation that will happen when 7 million people or more hit the streets in our communities. We have not fixed the housing crisis we have in this country right now. We already have a housing crisis that hasn't been fixed. So we cannot do this. So we're looking for the White House to act today.
Now, while she undoubtedly deserves some credit for hustling the Biden administration toward a new CDC moratorium, Representative Bush told The Takeaway that this should only be the beginning. She wants to see more extensive legislative action to protect families from eviction.
Once we get this moratorium, because I believe that the White House, will get this done. We won't stop. And I believe that they will. We want to partner with them. We're one team, you know, so there's no division here. We're one team. But as far as the leadership, you know, once this moratorium is done, we have to, that gives us some time to be able to work as a caucus, but then work on the both House and Senate sides to be able to say, like, look, we have to put something, we have to get this bill. You know, I would love to see Chairwoman Maxine Waters' bill passed in the House, and hopefully if Senator Sherrod Brown or someone else in the Senate is going to lead in the Senate, would love to get that done, because we need something more than these temporary fixes, even though that is another temporary fix. But we need to get something stronger so that people know that they have safety while we're working to get other things done.
You were in the streets for 400 days after the death of Michael Brown. How long you prepared to sleep on the streets or sleep on the steps of Congress?
You know,
let's not do it for 400 days.
Yeah. Look, I don't have an end date. The energy that it took to be able to be a part of a movement that lasted 400 days, where I was there for probably, I may have missed 10 out of the 400, literally. I'm prepared. I'm prepared to move with the moment. Let me say this, Melissa. When Ferguson was happening, we had no idea that the next day we would still need to be out there. It just kept rolling. Well, it was organic. That's how this is. So I don't know what the end date is, but I do know that I'm not moving until they move. And that movement has to be an eviction moratorium.
Congresswoman Cori Bush of Missouri, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Melissa.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and you're listening to The Takeaway. Last month, a Catholic news organization outed a priest as gay. He was forced to resign. Now, the publication reportedly used location data collected and sold by an app to reverse identify the priest. Now, what does that mean, reverse identify? Basically, by cross-referencing location data used from this location-based hookup app that the priest was using on his phone, the news organization was able to map the places he visited, which included gay bars and private residences. Now, this story got attention because of the high-profile nature of the individual involved. But the truth is, we're all vulnerable to this kind of reverse identification, and the potential consequences are troubling at best and devastating at worst. For more on this, we spoke with Alan Butler, Executive Director and President of the Electronic Privacy Information Center. And Alan walked me through the broader significance of the case where the priest was outed.
What this specific case reveals is the underlying kind of surveillance architecture of the internet, of mobile apps, and a lot of the really revealing data that's generated and collected and sort of transferred around between different entities about internet users all the time. And fundamentally, I think what is revealed by this is the fact that there really is not anonymity in any situation where an app or a data broker is collecting precise location information and is disclosing that to a third party. So in many situations, you may use, you know, a smartphone app to explicitly sort of signal your location, right? If you're in a map app or if you're trying to take the weather or something else, but turns out that there's a lot of apps that don't necessarily have anything to do with your location, but that nevertheless collect your location data. And it's a significant problem in the United States because these business practices have gone essentially unregulated in the U.S. for the last few decades.
Just how much information about us at a very sort of tiny, individual, identifiable level is available?
Sure, yeah. A lot of times this analytics data and other kind of big data is discussed in terms of its volume, right? And I think the companies that traffic in this type of information tend to try to mask how individualized and how precise it really is with the fact that they're collecting so much of it, right? So it's almost like, oh, well, these are just large data sets. We're just looking at trends. We're just looking at, you know, aggregate information. Well, any data set that contains unique identifiers can be used to correlate different types of data and to ultimately identify individuals, as happened in this particular case. And what I mean by that is every device, particularly take the example of a mobile smartphone, has a number of unique identifiers associated with it. Some are kind of baked in naturally, right? Your wireless internet device has an ID baked into it, or your Bluetooth device, if you connect to, you know, headphones or other devices, has an ID associated with it. And then your phone itself, many phones have another ID that's associated with the phone called an ad ID that's collected specifically by apps and other entities that are involved in serving, measuring, analyzing ads on the device. And so any data that's collected in connection with that device, let's say the fact that you opened a particular app. So in this example, we were talking about like the Grindr app, right? The fact that you opened and used the Grindr app at a particular time and potentially even in a specific place could be collected in connection with that specific ID. So yes, there's a mountain of data, but if all those data points can be connected to specific devices, then that data can be used to build a very detailed profile of the individual that's using that device.
So presumably, the purpose or the main purpose that this kind of information would then be used to build a profile, right, is to sell us things, right? That so much of what we hear about the privacy question is, okay, we're using these algorithms, we're finding this information in order to target to you, you know, either the politics or the, you know, consumption items that you want most. But how does it turn into not simply this data being sold to people who want to sell us things, which is a bad enough problem, but to those who might be surveilling us in this way?
I think what's important to understand is that fundamentally surveillance advertising is surveillance based, right? Sometimes it's referred to as targeted advertising. It's surveillance advertising, right? It is surveillance for the purpose of advertising. And anytime you build a surveillance system like that, especially in, as I said, in the United States, where we don't have comprehensive privacy and data protection rules that apply to all these services, you create opportunities for further surveillance and abuse. And so what that means in practical terms is that a company that is collecting all this data about mobile phones is not under current law prohibited, except in certain circumstances, from selling that data to someone else. And so what happened in this specific case we're talking about with Priest is that the sort of folks working on the story literally went out and bought all this data, right, and were able to analyze it and reverse trace it and identify the specific individual and what app he had been using and where he had been going. So yes, it can be used by advertisers, and it is, but it can be used by anyone else that collects it, including, let's say, foreign intelligence entities, right, or law enforcement, or other, you know, bounty hunters. Like there have been plenty of examples over the last few years where these data abuses have been uncovered and shown that, again, when you build a surveillance system, you're facilitating surveillance.
And what kind of legislation, what sort of legislative landscape, as you've been talking about it, would help to regulate and address these concerns?
Sure. Well, what's needed in the United States is a comprehensive data protection regime, like the one that exists in Europe. There have been attempts in some states over the last few years to erect some rules and some guardrails at the state level. So California passed the California Privacy Rights Act last year as a ballot initiative, and previously they passed a piece of legislation, the CCPA, that protects individual privacy. So California has been kind of upgrading the state-level privacy protections. In the last year, we've seen Virginia and Colorado both pass laws, and we've seen a number of states, including Florida and Maine and Oklahoma and other states, consider legislation. What's needed is a comprehensive set of laws that define the rights of individuals, data subjects, and impose obligations and responsibilities on entities that collect and process personal information, right? It really needs to be across the board. Historically, in the United States, especially at the federal level, what we've had over the last 40 years are these kind of very narrow sectoral laws that, let's say, protect privacy in certain contexts in related to health data, that's HIPAA, or related to communications, electronic communications, that's sometimes called ECPA, or the Stored Communications Act, or other very narrow examples like the Video Privacy Protection Act, which protects video rental records. So we have a very kind of stovepipe system in the United States, and what's needed is a comprehensive set of rules that applies to all entities.
What can ordinary folks who are using apps right now do to begin to help to protect themselves before this legislation is actually part of our landscape?
With respect to some of these business practices, there's really not much that individual users can do. There are, you know, apps do increasingly have their own built-in privacy settings that do actually provide some controls for what data is collected or how that data is used. And some of the app platforms, like Apple's operating system, do provide built-in controls as well that can help. So, for example, that ad ID that I mentioned, which is a unique identifier that is used for advertising, Apple's mobile operating system actually allows you in the privacy settings to turn that off, to essentially zero it out, so that that piece of data cannot actually be collected about you. And there is also newer features that allow you to similarly scramble essentially the IDs associated with your Bluetooth signals or your Wi-Fi signals.
Alan Butler is the executive director of the Electronic Privacy Information Center. Alan, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Last weekend in Chicago, the music festival Lollapalooza was the hottest ticket in town. A crowd of roughly 100,000 people packed into the city's Grant Park for each day of the festival, where they partied like it was 2019. Headliners included Young Thug, Megan Thee Stallion, and Tyler, the Creator.
Lollapalooza! It's Lollapalooza, but I like saying Lola, whatever. This feels crazy.
According to festival organizers, 90% of attendees last Thursday showed proof of vaccination, and the rest of the crowd brought documentation of negative COVID tests. But with the Delta variant continuing to pose a threat nationwide, health experts say that being in a tightly packed crowd is quite risky, regardless of vaccination status. Here's what WNYC health and science editor Sikon Akpan told Brian Lehrer on Tuesday.
I mean, I attended Lollapalooza this in like 2007, and I remember seeing Radiohead, and they did this thing where they dropped the barriers right before the show started, and everybody just rushed forward, and you're packed in, and I could barely breathe. In that situation, Delta is going to find a way to get from nose to nose. And so 80, 90% of outdoor scenarios are probably completely safe, right? Because you're going to be far enough away from people to be fine. But if you're really, really packed into a tight space, then yeah, you're giving the virus a better chance of spreading outdoors.
Lollapalooza is just one of many major music festivals planned for this year. Bonnaroo, Made in America, and Governor's Ball all remain on the calendar for the moment. And while musicians are badly in need of a break after a year of practically no live concerts, whether these massive festivals are worth the risk is another matter. Joining me now to discuss is Jim DeRogatis, co-host of Sound Opinions, a nationally syndicated radio show. Jim is also associate professor at Columbia College Chicago and a longtime music critic. Jim, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Thank you, Melissa.
And also with us is Kim Bellware, a reporter covering national and breaking news for The Washington Post. She was recently reporting on music festivals happening amid the pandemic. Kim, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So, Kim, you went to and reported on the festival last Thursday. How did it just feel to be around people and music and fun?
In this situation, it felt a little nerve-wracking. It was all of the things that these festivals typically are. It was hot. It was crowded. There was no small amount of confusion. I went just one day on the first day to report. And I did the entire process that people with general admission would do, and standing in line and buying a ticket and going through those checkpoints. And it was a lot of people and not a lot of distancing.
Were there masks?
In a word, no. I think I counted throughout the entire day. This is including attendees, including staff, volunteers, ballpark range, maybe 40 to 60 masks the entire day. And the early numbers for attendance was about 380,000 people in attendance.
So when you were going through the general admission process, how closely were the staff of the festival kind of checking those vaccination cards?
In my experience, when I went through, I had my vaccination card in a, you know, kind of laminated pocket, and the person at the checkpoint barely gave it a passing glance. As I was showing it to him, another woman ran alongside me and threw up her arms and whooped in the air because nobody even looked. And then she made it to the next checkpoint where they check your bags, which was a more thorough inspection, and nobody stopped her. So in the one experience that I saw, it was not strong. I did talk to other festival goers, and they did say that they felt that their records or their negative tests were scrutinized.
Okay, Jim, what did the mayor, Lori Lightfoot, and maybe also the Illinois governor say about why they let this proceed?
Well, they never gave a clear reason, not based on science anyway. You know, the mayor kept saying she thought it was safe. The chief health official in the city of Chicago, Dr. Allison Arwady, was backing her up. But meanwhile, we had great infectious disease specialists like Dr. Emily Landon, chief of infectious disease at University of Chicago, you know, all over the media saying this is, quote, this is a terrible idea. And it seemed to me that the mayor, in her desire to assuage downtown businesses, fill the hotels, fill the restaurants, was not recognizing the cultural difference of a festival like Lollapalooza with 100,000 a day of a particular demographic versus Wrigley Field or Sox Stadium filling up for a baseball game. 40,000 if it's maxed. You know, this is not a controlled venue. Lollapalooza, you know, Grant Park is 1.3 miles from tip to tip. We saw video online of gate crashing. We saw a video of what Kim was describing. Some people having their cards scrutinized and others just being waved in. You know, the mayor at a press conference after the festival was asked about Lollapalooza. She kept being asked. She said, well, 90% was vaccinated. And a reporter stood up from the Chicago Tribune and asked, where does that figure come from? And she said it comes from a tweet by Lollapalooza's promoters. That's not science. We didn't see any evidence of how they were logging vaccinations. There was no electronic database or anything like that.
Yeah, because I'm so happy that you clarified that number, because I thought 90% would basically make that the most vaccinated space in America. And particularly given how young everyone is, that might be actually all the vaccinated young people, right, sort of in the country in that space. But that's helpful to understand that that's probably more like self-attestation of being vaccinated rather than any kind of clear evidence of it.
Well, yeah, the number's fake, you know, and I think, again, cultural difference. We're not realizing how closely packed those people were, literally on top of each other at the front of the stage, sometimes for hours before the act they wanted to see. Tyler, the Creator, drew a tremendous crowd, right? And so those people are on top of each other, and there's, you know, it was stage diving, and there was, slamming or body surfing, real close physical contact. You know, and the vaccines are 95% effective, but even 5% of a crowd of 100,000, 1% of a crowd of 100,000, we're talking about significant number of infections. And, you know, the scientist, Dr. Arwady, while agreeing with the mayor that it should happen, was saying, there'll almost certainly be infections coming out of this. You know, that's not acceptable, I don't think, Melissa.
So, Kim, let me come to this. Is there an argument to be made? I absolutely hear Jim's argument about all the public health reasons why we shouldn't have the festivals. Is there an argument to be made for why we should?
Well, what the infectious disease experts that I've been talking to over the past month, they were pretty clear to say, let's not think of this in terms of are music festivals safe or unsafe, because safe implies you won't get infected. And that's just not something that you can guarantee unless you stay home. So they said, look at it on a spectrum of risk. And that includes what the factors on the ground are, how many people around you are vaccinated, how much space is there, how much are people masking, and then what are your own vulnerabilities? Do you live in a household where there are unvaccinated children, where there are people with comorbidities, and that kind of thing? When I asked these experts just personally, them speaking as individuals, what would you do? What activities are you doing? They either said, I would not go to a festival like this with the conditions that we described, or they said, I would go if I could control certain factors, like everybody around me is vaccinated. They also said that having these safety precautions is better than nothing. The Rolling Loud Music Festival in Miami that happened just 2 weeks ago, that didn't have any restrictions whatsoever. They said, we're going to leave it up to people. They can make up their own mind. Now, Lollapalooza, they were requiring proof of vaccination. And if you're not vaccinated, a negative test, which within 72 hours of entry. Notable that they had changed that number several times. It had been 24 hours, 72, and 48 hours. And they didn't offer a lot of clarity on what that meant as far as, can you present one negative test and you're good for all 4 days, or do you have to do it on a rolling basis so that, you know, 72-hour window is always fresh? But, you know, they also said if you're not vaccinated, then you need to be masked up in the festival, which all of these things comport with science, but not with actual human behavior, and definitely not with how music festivals run. And the one thing, too, about this behavior is nothing that I saw was out of the ordinary, which right. means it was all predictable. You know, the crowds and people being very fashion conscious and squeezing together for photos and hugging and drinking and all of that. This happens every single year at Lollapalooza. So the fact that they were, you know, hoping the honor system would be in place, that definitely makes it much higher risk in the estimation of these infectious disease experts.
So, Jim, let me because I agree, as I listened to both of you speak, I was thinking, yep, that sounds like a music festival, right? It just sounds like what happened in 2017, 18, 19. Obviously, though, we're in a different moment. But again, I'm wondering, you know, you mentioned the sort of downtown business interests, undoubtedly the mayor and the governor's political interests. Is there any good reason for allowing this to go forward by simply saying, look, a year and a half into a pandemic, people simply do know what the risks are here. And if they're making that choice, that's the choice they're making.
Well, the other negative impact besides people getting sick, Melissa, is every music venue in the city that has struggled to hold on after 14 or 15 months darkness, where they could not be open, they were shut down since last March. The Save Our Stages money approved by Congress, I think it's 3 months ago now, still has not flowed to these small music venues and theaters and other cultural institutions, although it was approved. You know, they're lucky to be alive today. They are trepidatiously reopening now with far more diligent mask requirements and vaccination checks. And many are banning. If you are not vaccinated, no test. You're not allowed. You're not coming in. Metro in Chicago, 1,200 capacity, just announced that yesterday. So my fear is that if the Delta infections at Lollapalooza and reopening too big, too fast, cause another spike, we're going to see not only music venues, but bars and restaurants who are holding on by the skin of their teeth just reopening have to close again. My concern is not 4 days of a corporate festival that invades Chicago once a year. It is those 365 days a year cultural institutions. New York has them. Chicago has them. We're lucky to still have them at this point in time in 2021.
For me, that is perhaps the strongest. Certainly human health is at the top. But that argument feels to me like one that could actually be sold for a politician, right? For someone who is running for office, for someone who is representing the people, to be able to make an argument about the long-term viability of music venues, of gathering spaces for people who actually live in the city, as opposed to festival goers. And don't get me wrong, I mean, you know, New Orleans is my city, and it's, you know, during parts of the year, it's like an all-time, you know, music festival. But at the same time, it's really about the people who actually live there. Kim, while you were there, was anyone talking about that? Were there people in the crowd who you spoke with who felt a sense of maybe angst about the long-term impact of their presence at Lollapalooza?
No, and I would say that a lot of the people that I talked to on Thursday were not from Chicago. They were from out of state, which means that they were getting on a plane and traveling there. So, you know, something that I know Jim has been critical of with the festival is that it's so big, and part of it is that it's a destination draw, but it also doesn't have the same community that is fostered by some of these smaller venues or smaller festivals. So, you know, I don't know that that was really on the minds of very many people, because they don't exactly have a stake in what happens. And, you know, one of the other things too, I can't speak to the mindset of everybody at the festival, but something that I thought of too is, what's the price that everybody else in Chicago who didn't go to Lollapalooza might have to pay for this large event? And I think the CTA workers, the hotel workers, the, you know, front of house staff at bars. And when you saw photos of what happened after the festival, people are packed like sardines into the L cars on the CTA. And those are people who, you know, maybe they don't know anybody who is a bus driver or who is one of the train engineers, and maybe they don't care. But there was a real disconnect between, I think, some of the actions that were going on at the park and what the impact of those actions could be for everybody else in the city.
Exactly on that question of impact, Jim, is there going to be an attempt to follow sort of how these COVID cases look in the city, you know, over the course of the next 2 weeks in the aftermath of Lollapalooza? And will concert organizers be held accountable if there is sort of a discernible spike?
Well, you know, the corporate owners, Live Nation, Ticketmaster, they're out of town already, and so are C3, who owns a portion. They're the Texas promoters. I don't think the concert will be held accountable if we see large numbers of spiking cases. I think that Chicago will just be paying for it.
Jim DeRogatis is the co-host of Sound Opinions, a longtime music critic and associate professor. Kim Bellware is a reporter covering national and breaking news for The Washington Post. Thank you both so much, and be safe out there.
Thank you, Melissa.
Thanks for having us.
Here's another bit of political news we're watching. On Tuesday, New York State Attorney General Letitia James released the findings of an investigation her office conducted into the state's governor, Andrew Cuomo. Multiple women have accused Governor Cuomo of sexual harassment and of creating a toxic work environment.
The independent investigation has concluded that Governor Andrew Cuomo sexually harassed multiple women, and in doing so violated federal and state law.
Governor Andrew Cuomo responded by disputing the report's findings.
First, I want you to know directly from me that I never touched anyone inappropriately or made inappropriate sexual advances. I am 63 years old. I've lived my entire adult life in public view. That is just not who I am. And that's not who I have ever been.
We'll be talking about that and the mounting pressure, including from President Biden, for Cuomo to resign this week. And we want to hear from you. Share your reactions by leaving a voicemail at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. Or send a voice memo to takeawaycallers@gmail.com. That's all for us today. You can always find us on Facebook and leave a comment there, or on Twitter at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and this is The Takeaway.